Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everyone. I'd like to start by asking you to talk to each other a little bit in service of developing a sense of connection, community, what in Buddhism we talk about as refuge in the Sangha. And tonight I'm going to talk about the aspect of our practice of Buddhism that is about creating a positive change in the world. Service, generosity, engagement. Sometimes we talk about engaged Buddhism. I'm going to talk about that tonight. And the outcome of the wisdom and the compassion that we're trying to develop in our own lives and how we apply that to helping, serving, influencing, educating, supporting a positive change. And this planet has so many areas that could use some positive change, whether it's issues around the planet itself and the environment, around human relationships, around equality, around, you know, addressing sexism or racism or homophobia or the animals, addressing the animal cruelty, the factory farming, the abuse and neglect of animals, or things around helping people, whether it's service to young people or helping addicts or people in institutions, prisons. So reflecting for a moment on what you're currently doing, if you are, and maybe it's more aspirational, but how are you using your life's energy, time and energy to help others, to create a positive change? How does your Buddhist aspiration to be compassionate become action in the world? What kind of compassionate actions are you taking or trying to take, or maybe you aspire to take? Maybe you're kind of like, oh, hey, I'm just, you know, I just got out of rehab. I'm just trying to get off a crack. I'm not helping anybody yet. Maybe. That's okay. You're welcome here. That we were all in that place at one point. And then if you hang around and you do your practice, then that intention to be compassionate towards our own pain also becomes an intention to be more altruistic, more generous, more engaged in and addressing the corruption and ignorance and confusion on this planet, the wars and the violence and the harm that's being caused to the planet itself and to then all of the people and the animals and the, you know, this planet that we live on that's, you know, pretty fucked in a lot of ways. How are you helping? What are you doing about it? What service are you involved in? So small groups to discuss that engagement, service, creating a positive change. What are you doing? And then I'll talk about some of the Buddha's teachings and we'll meditate and we'll take it from there. So find two or three people, get a small group going. Primarily think about the Buddha's teachings and the path of transformation from the inside out. As we transform, as we develop more understanding, more wisdom, more compassion, more appreciation, that becomes engaged action in creating a positive change, being of service, being generous, being connected. I think I tend to think of it that way because that was my experience. I wasn't in politically or socially, or I wasn't doing any service or any before I started practicing. But then as I started practicing, it became more imperative to give, to try to create a positive change. That's not everybody's experience. Some people come from socialist, socially engaged, activist communities and have been spending a lot of their lives trying to change the world, and then kind of find themselves suffering so much about trying to change the world that they find the Buddhist path to try to find some internal sense of well-being, and then kind of find that balance between trying to change the world and find some happiness, well-being, peace in internally. So we'll talk about both perspectives. But first we'll meditate, so find a way to be that is upright, relaxed, find a posture that feels comfortable to begin with, but also sustainable. Adjusting your body so that the spine is erect without being rigid, the body is upright without being stiff. Allowing your eyes to be gently closed. Allowing your face to be relaxed as possible, releasing any tension around the eyes and the brow or in the jaw. Letting gravity pull the shoulders a little bit away from the ears. If they're up, let the shoulders release. Breathing in, bring awareness to the sensations that the breath creates at the nostrils. And breathing out, see if you can soften your belly, release the unnecessary tension in the trunk of the body, if you can. And then try to allow the body to breathe all by itself. Try not to control the breath. The body knows how to breathe. We're just bringing awareness to what's happening. And as we establish mindfulness in the body, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness, put some emphasis on the intention to be kind. A kind attitude, a kind awareness, a kind intention towards how we meet our experience with friendliness, with patience, with tolerance and acceptance. Disengaging from the mind's tendency to think about the future and the past, and directing our full attention to the present time experience of the body, the first foundation of mindfulness. Breathing in with awareness, mindfulness of the breath. Breathing out with awareness, knowing that you're breathing out. Focusing our attention on the sensations the breath creates in the body. when the attention is drawn away from the chosen object, the breath, the body, back into thinking or hearing, just redirect, come back, disengage from the mind's plans and memories, hopes and fears, come back to the sensation, back to the breath. We're doing so with this attitude of kindness, friendliness, patience. We pay attention to our present time experience to understand, to see more clearly the nature of impermanence, how each breath comes and goes, every sensation arising and passing. Awareness in the body also teaches us about the impersonal nature, how the body breathes all by itself. The next task is to investigate and identify the feeling tone of our experience. What are we perceiving as pleasant, likable, agreeable, comfortable? What are we feeling, perceiving, experiencing as unpleasant, uncomfortable, hard to bear, painful? And what are we experiencing, perceiving as neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, all of the parts of the body that we can feel? Sensation, but neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Just phenomena, just feeling, just sensation. Investigating the feeling tone in the body, but including the body's experience of emotion, joy and sorrow, including the body's experience of the other sense doors, sounds, smell, taste, sight. And rather than ignoring the mind, include the mind. Turn towards thoughts and emotions that are arising, passing through awareness with the same interest in the process of impermanence, arising and passing, and identification of what is feeling pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral, a feeling tone of your mood, of your thoughts, of your emotions. Impermanent, unpleasant sensation and emotion. Impermanent, pleasant sensation, thoughts, emotions. present time, non-judgmental, kind investigation of the impermanent nature of the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral phenomena we experience when we pay attention. Awareness reveals what's happening moment to moment and how it feels. And it also shows us how we're responding, relating, or reacting to our pain, the aversion, the resistance, or the acceptance, the tolerance, and the compassion. We try to incline our heart, our mind, towards caring about our unpleasant thoughts and feelings, sensations, emotions. It's a bit counter-instinctual to meet pain with friendliness rather than fear and resistance. We try to incline our mind, our heart, towards letting go, towards not clinging to that which is perceived as pleasant, experienced as agreeable, delightful. The tendency to cling, to crave, to become attached. Just creates more suffering when we cling to the impermanent. So in meditation, training the mind to let go. Perhaps even at times in your meditation, just putting those two words, let go. Let go of the past. Let go of the future. Let go of even needing the present to be any different than it is. my understanding, my sense is that the Buddha's primary teaching style, message was to the individual of how to end suffering in your life. Here's the reality of human suffering, first noble truth. Here's the cause, second noble truth, the repetitive craving, clinging, just what we're doing in meditation, you know, seeing that our relationship to pleasure, pain, neutrality, repetitive craving, causing suffering for us. The truth that it's possible to end suffering, that through your own actions, you can stop clinging and creating all of that attachment, clinging, suffering that we create for ourselves. Stop hating, stop meeting life with aversion, resistance, develop compassion, acceptance. Stop being so selfish and self-centered, taking it all so personal, I, me, mine, that the third noble truth is this wonderful, the good news, it's possible to stop suffering about the human condition. Can't get rid of the human condition, can't get rid of the pain, can't get rid of the pleasure, can't get rid of the mind that creates a self, but through the Eightfold Path, developing the wisdom and the ethics and the meditative understanding, insight, wisdom of meditation, that we no longer have to suffer, maybe at all, or at least, you know, we can even lower the bar a little bit. You don't have to suffer so much. Maybe you'll still suffer some, but you don't have to suffer so much. Decrease, radical decrease. And the Buddha spent 40 years, you know, wandering around teaching people, here's how you can end suffering. And there's some places where there's a sense of engagement. Like it's said that one of the first things that the Buddha would teach when he came into contact with a new group of people who came to listen to him is that he would first speak about the importance of generosity. If people came and said, hey, I want to get free from, you know, I heard you know the path to enlightenment. I heard you can teach this thing. Teach me meditation. He'd say, before I teach you meditation or these, first, the importance of giving, of being not selfish, of being not attached to our things, to our wealth, to our time, to our energy, to break the suffering of selfish, self-centered human condition by giving. And there's some often quoted, at one point he said, if you understood the importance of generosity, of being of service, of giving, of sharing, he said, you wouldn't let a single meal go by without sharing some of your food, literally some of your, with other people who are less fortunate, who are hungry, who have less than you do. And so that this idea of generosity not being something that we do occasionally, not just like, I'm going to go do the beach cleanup, you know, once every season, or I'm going to go, which is also good, not dissing the beach cleanup. But him kind of saying, like, try to integrate giving, generosity, service into your daily life. Just as you eat every day, can you share some of your time, your energy, your resources with those who have less? To break that clinging to what I have and what I'm going to get and what I need and what I think, you know, I want to keep. So I think that's a, you know, important place for us all to reflect and not to judge ourselves and be like, I don't do it every day. I don't share my food. I keep my leftovers. I got food left. I'm saving it for later. I'm not feeding a homeless drug addict. Fuck that. So not to judge yourself, but to just reflect on, okay, I don't want to suffer from this self-obsession. I'd like to break that. I'd like to be free from thinking about myself all of the time. I'd like to be more altruistic. I'm not there yet, but that fake it till you make it, that, you know, part, I feel like the Buddha saying, like, start generosity before you feel generous. Sometimes we think like, well, I got to wait until once I have enough wisdom, then I'll feel generous. Then I'll feel like, and rather than waiting, I feel like there's an encouragement from the Buddha that says, in order to get free from the suffering of selfishness, of clinging, of craving, of attachment, practice non-attachment, even if you don't feel like it yet. Practice giving. Practice sharing, practice being of service. So, I mean, this was when I started practicing meditation. I started recovery from addiction and Buddhist practice at the same time. And I was getting the 12-step message and the Buddhist message. And one of the things that I appreciate to this day so much about the 12-step message is that encouragement to be of service to others. That encouragement to not be so selfish and to say, how can I help other addicts? I always thought that kind of just helping other alcoholics and addicts was a little too small, and maybe that was the Buddhist influence. Like, absolutely, the reason that those recovery programs work, whether it's the 12 steps or refuge recovery, is that peer-led, that part of our principle is, I'm going to be of service to you. Just, people are going to be of service to me, and we're going to pass it on by free from charge service work. I'm going to share my time and energy with you. You're going to share your time and energy with them. Somebody shared their time and energy with me, and that, you know, such a beautiful model. And it's kind of like the Buddhist model too. Like, you know, the Buddha was just walking around teaching for free, saying like, hey, here's what I've done, and here's what you can do, and here's the Four Noble Truths, and here's the Eightfold Path. And now, when you understand this, then pass it on to someone else who's interested. And there's a reason why Buddhism originally wasn't written down for the first 200 years. It was an oral tradition. With part of that, of like, stay connected to giving this away to each other. And it seems like the Buddha knew, like, as soon as we write it down, people are going to start selling it. People are going to, you know, they're going to commodify it. And then also the church and Buddhism becomes this religion. And then, you know, you have to understand the Pali, or you have to, you know, the kind of ancient languages. And you know, he said, like, in this culture where only a small percentage of the culture is literate, once we write it down, he was literate because he came from a somewhat of a privileged, educated background, but most of the country wasn't literate. So as soon as we write it down, then it belongs to the upper class. And it belongs, you know, and it's what happened in Hinduism, where they wrote it down in Sanskrit, and then you had to go and pay the priests to recite the prayers for you, because you couldn't read them. And it wasn't given away freely. He said, we need to keep this thing in this spirit of generosity and giving and paying it forward and sharing your direct experience with each other. Teachers and students in a lineage of freely offered teachings. I take most of my, so some of it's explicit, like the Buddha's, you know, insistence, start with generosity. Don't wait till you're feeling it. Just start giving, start practicing that. Break your selfishness through letting go, even if you don't want to. I take most of my inspiration when it comes to engaged Buddhism and creating a positive change, not so much in the explicit teachings, but in my understanding of the Buddha's life, of what he chose to do. And even this example of, you know, he created this tradition, and he didn't sell it. He gave it away. He didn't commodify it and say, like, okay, look, we can really turn this into a really cool pyramid scheme and I can get rich. He'd walked away from that. And he said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life giving these teachings for free. And not just the teachings to the individual, although I think that that was the main mission was, how do I teach humans to end suffering? Give them these Four Noble Truths, this Eightfold Path. But then when it was appropriate and the questions were asked and the situations came up, he was politically controversial about war. He was an anti-war, you know, I mean, the teachings of compassion, the teachings of nonviolence. He was outspoken against violence ever being a solution, war ever being a reasonable reaction to what was happening in the culture. And so in that way, you know, there's this sort of anti-violence, anti-war, anti-ignorance political stance. You know, at this point, we kind of think like, oh, that's kind of getting kind of political. But I don't think that the Buddha, you know, thought about it as politics. It's just wisdom. Wisdom is violence is never the appropriate response. War, invasion, colonizing is never the appropriate response to what's happening. It's always just going to create more suffering. Likewise with gender relations and race relations, although it's not so explicit in anywhere in the kind of traditional path to freeing ourselves from suffering, there was over and over these circumstances in the Buddha's life where he addressed the inequality and gender inequality, sexism, and probably, I mean, I'm not enough of a historian or a scholar, but it seems like it's true that the Buddha was the first person in that ancient Indian sexist culture to empower women and even acknowledge women's divinity, you know, in this very patriarchal culture and in the caste system and in the kind of Brahmana Hindu system where women, you know, there's even I think to this day a sort of sense in some of those Indian cultures that incarnation as a woman is like bad karma. And he was one of the first people to be like, we're not these bodies, we're not this gender, and we have to stop oppressing each other about our race and our gender. And you know, he created an order of nuns and said, of course women can get enlightened. Where, you know, and this is at a time where women weren't even allowed to the, you know, inner sanctums of the temples in the Hindu tradition. Like you couldn't even go in, females couldn't even go in to a lot of those places. And he created a whole kind of like, yes, let's support the women and let's, you know, create a whole radical culture of enlightenment for the nuns and for the female householders. And this was, you know, totally engaged wisdom. And again, he didn't see, I don't think he saw himself or that as this sort of like political, you know, stance, just wisdom, just the reality of oppressing each other is ignorance. It, you know, like I'm not, it's not this radical statement. It's just like, yeah, this is fucking ludicrous that we're oppressing each other. And likewise with the caste system and all of the racism of his culture, all of the racism of our culture, the modern caste system that continues in so many ways in India and here and on the rest of the planet. And his, you know, kind of what Buddhism created was a meritocracy based on how you show up, not your gender, not your race, not your socioeconomic background, not your level of education, but on your ethics, on your commitments to renunciation, to practice, to, so in the monastic system, your level in the hierarchy, whether it's the matriarchy and the nuns or the patriarchy and the monks side, is, you know, how long have you been committed? How much time have you put in? Not what is your race, what is your background, what is your education, what is your wealth, any of that stuff. Creating a equal opportunity for power and, you know, rank or whatever within the Sangha, based on the time you put in, your merit, your effort. I feel like one of the most pressing issues of our time, you might feel differently about this, but my sense is one of the most pressing issues is the climate change and the this is of course something that the Buddha did not address, because 2600 years ago it wasn't happening as far as we know. Maybe it was already starting to happening. I don't know. They're burning a lot of coal back then. Maybe, you know, it starts, you know, humans making fires probably started to fuck up the environment a long time ago. But when I think of creating a positive change on this planet, I think about, like, what kind of planet are we going to have left with all of the negative effects that humanity has had on the planet, with the reality of climate change and global warming and, you know, this hole in the ozone that we've been talking about for 50 years and all of its effects on this planet. And I, in the Buddhist world that I've been involved in a long time, there's been a lot of kind of trying to address it and trying to organize and be engaged and organize sanghas around, education and action and tree planting and whatever we can do. And it feels like there's sort of cycles of topics. And it also feels very personal when it comes to being engaged, being of service, being politically, socially active, engaged. I've always had this sense of, like, rather than there's one thing that's fits all, and, like, as a good person, good Buddhist, good, you should be addressing this. I always feel like it's a little bit more personal of, like, how do you want to use your life's energy? What is the cause? There's so many, whether it's the environment or the animals, or it's more about, you know, gender relations or race relations, or maybe it's about politics. Maybe you're very interested in American bipartisan politics, and you're a nationalist, and you care about this country, and you want this country to be more just, more, you know. Maybe it's politics in our sort of. Maybe it's the elderly. Maybe it's the incarcerated. Maybe it's the homeless, houseless. Maybe it's the, right? I just feel like there's so many different groups and issues and, a lot of us are in recovery. So it's about, how do I help other addicts recover? I feel so grateful that I've been able to escape active addiction and have this life of recovery. And I want to help other people do that. And I put more of my time and energy into that than I do environmental activism, or than I do towards addressing animal cruelty. Or I Does it make sense what I'm saying? Like my feeling is it doesn't matter so much what cause you throw your time and energy into. But what does matter is that as an outcome of compassion and as a process of developing generosity and breaking the self-centeredness and developing compassion, that part of our path is service. Part of our path is helping others in a way. And I feel like there's a, I don't know if this bias is necessary. It's a little bit of a Buddhist bias and a little bit of a recovery bias that I have, which is a service that you are not compensated for. Because I know, like, as I became a psychotherapist, or I see this with a lot of social workers, or even I can see it in myself as a Dharma teacher. Like, you know, like my role as a Dharma teacher, I want to be of service. I've been showing up and teaching these classes for a long time, decades. I don't charge anybody for it. So you can see it on some level, it's my service, but I actually do get some donations. So when I think of my own service work and engagement, I don't feel like Dharma teaching, it totally counts. It's a little bit like social work or being a therapist. Like I'm being even though I'm not charging you, I'm still being compensated. When I teach the retreat, I get the donations. When I teach the classes, I get the donations. So I'm being compensated for my generosity in some way. Unlike when you're sponsoring somebody or you're mentoring somebody or you're showing up for years, I volunteered for hospice. Or I volunteered in prisons, all of those times where I was showing up and giving my time and energy to an addict or to a prisoner or to a dying person, and I was receiving nothing but karma, no compensation except for merit, except for karma, except for the act of giving. We see this in recovery a lot where people are, you know, kind of engaged in giving, engaged in service. And then they start working at a rehab or they start working, they become a therapist, they become a social worker or something. And then they start being compensated for it. And they're like, well, I'm given all of the time. It's not the same when you're being paid. It's not really giving when you're being paid. And that importance of both. I mean, hey, right livelihood, yes, absolutely. Find a career where you're helping people, where you're doing something positive and you're making a living. Absolutely. Right livelihood and service are two different things. And that importance and I feel like part of the bias in, for me, of like studying with monks and who are full-time professional Buddhists. And they don't get any monetary compensation for it. Any money you give to them goes into, you know, the monastery or, you know, goes into some foundation, but they're not, you know, like I'm going to go next week and go on retreat with my teacher, Ajahn Amar. I've been studying with him for a long time, over 30 years. And he's, you know, one of the most famous monks in this Western tradition, and he's the abbot. He's the kind of the highest in the patriarchy of that male monastic lineage. On some level, he's the boss. He's been doing it for almost 50 years, I think. He could disrobe. He could walk away. If he stays in, you know, he keeps his status. He could walk away tomorrow. He's probably raised people have probably given millions and millions of dollars because he inspired them. It all goes to the monastery. If he disrobed tomorrow, nothing, no retirement. No, he doesn't get to keep any of that millions of dollars that were given to the Dharma in his name. And it's that act of, I'm doing this for generosity. I'm doing this to be of service. I'm not doing this just so that I can pay my bills. And it's the nice thing about the monastics. They take this life where it's like, we got no bills. We're renunciates. We don't actually have a mortgage. We only have what's offered to us. We don't build unless people have given us money to build it. We don't borrow, just what's been offered. I said earlier, my sense is, and I feel like this is a bit biased, but my sense is, because it was my experience, I know this isn't everybody's experience, but I came to the Dharma suffering so much and desperate for some solution, desperate for some help, desperate for some wisdom, and totally out of selfish need. I need to stop suffering so much. I need to stop being a drug addict. I need to stop being incarcerated. I need to, and I'll meditate if it will help me. Meditation will help me. Okay, I'll try it. I'm desperate enough. I'll try it. I will try to do it if it will help me. And again, it's that sort of I, me, mine, early stage of path. I'll do this if it will help me. And then even those sort of early, like, well, be of service to others because it will help you. Be generous because it will help you. And that kind of early sense of giving where you're like, I fucking hate everybody, but I'll give if it'll help me. You're telling me that if I'm generous, it'll help me? Okay, I'll fucking help you as long as it helps me. I'll take your call if it helps me. And that sort of selfish service, which is, I think, developmentally appropriate in the beginning. It's like, I'm not altruistic yet. I'm not just being of service out of gratitude in the beginning. But then after some years of practice and of recovery and of transformation, of starting to see that, like, there's that shift from I'm here for me, for actually, I'm pretty good. I found some balance. I found some wisdom. I found some compassion. And I'm not taking your call for me. I'm actually, I mean, I still might benefit from it. You know, there's still that, like, there's that tricky thing is, like, is there actually a act of selfless service? You know, because on this side, like, altruism, which is like, this is not about me. I'm just giving 100%. But because you always benefit on some level from giving, it's just in the motivation. Early motivation is selfish. And then that shifts and it starts to be less selfish and more like, I'm going to still benefit from being of service to you. I know that it feels good. It's healthy. It breaks my self-cherishing attitudes, my, you know, fear-based clinging, I mean, mine tendencies, but that's not really the motivation anymore. The motivation is, how can I help? Not for me, but really, how can I use my life's energy to create a positive change on this planet? So wherever you're at in that process, you know, you might be new. And you might still be in, like, I'm contemplating this. I don't know if I want to give my time, my energy, my money, my resources. I just want to learn to meditate so I don't suffer so much. I think if you keep going, you will experience a major shift. And it's not so much about you anymore. It's a lifestyle of service, a lifestyle of generosity, and an ongoing commitment. And as long as you don't get caught in that trap of, like, well, I have right livelihood, that's good enough. I don't need to continue giving. Like, I'm always so, I don't know, honestly, a little bit judgmental and kind of disappointed of the people in long-term Sangha practice or long-term recovery practice who at some point stop coming because they're like, I'm just not getting that much out of it anymore. And it's like, well, that statement means you missed the whole fucking point. Because you come in the beginning to get something out of it, and you stick around to give it back, to be supportive, to encourage and support the other people. You don't always just come for getting your own selfish needs met. You come to give. You know, you stick around the recovery program so that you can be of service. You stick around the Sangha so that you can welcome the new people and say, like, yeah, this shit really works. And there were people here when I got here and was skeptical about whether Buddhism really works or not. And now I get to be that person who supports the new people. It's not all up to the teacher. It's the Sangha's job. Couple last things and then see if you have any thoughts. So I want to frame this as, like, how does the Dharma create a positive change in the world. And like I said, there's all of these intentional actions that we can do. But the inside out perspective, which is that the more you develop compassion, the more you become a compassionate, tolerant, loving, forgiving person, just in you, the less reactive you are in your family, the less reactive you are at work, the less reactive, the more kind, the more generous, the more compassionate you are walking down the street. That in itself, our personal transformation, is a positive change on this planet. Now, I know for sure there's some people in here where this neighborhood, this room right now, is so much safer because you are practicing the Dharma. I know that's true about me. I know that's true about a bunch of us in here, where the Dharma has taught us not to lie and not to steal and not to intentionally cause harm. And that awakening, that transformation, that shift in our lives is actually an act of generosity to everyone we come into contact with. I'm not so reactive. I'm not so angry. I'm not dishonest. I'm not going to steal from you. I'm not going to hurt you intentionally anyways. I might offend you, but... And that level of creating a positive change from how you show up in all of your relationships, creating a positive change in your family from, you know, breaking whatever cycle of dysfunction your family may or may not be stuck in, but being able to show up in whatever way you do with more wisdom, with more love, with more kindness, with more compassion. And I don't want to dismiss that piece as we change. We are influencing change in the people that are around us. I don't know how many of this has happened to yet, but it happened to me a lot, especially in the early days of people being like, wow, like something, what are you doing? People noticing like, wow, you're a really less of an asshole. You're more patient. You're more tolerant. You're more kind. You're more generous. What are you doing? You know, and I'm meditating. That's what I'm doing. I'm training my mind. I'm practicing the five precepts. I'm following the Eightfold Path. Trying, you know, this path is what's transforming me. It's not like I just made a decision to do it. I am following this path, and this is what happens. You become less reactive and more friendly and more kind and more awake, less asleep, less reactive. So with 10 minutes or so for questions, comments, dialogue, what are your thoughts about this? Nate, go ahead. You can jump in, start us off.
Well, it was right before you said the word this. I've been curious. I've been coming to you for years now, dude. Curious, you know, Vesak never comes up with that right around the bend here. Was curious if you have any comments as to why, you know, our little sect here doesn't, you know, talk too much about Buddhist holidays. I know that's off topic, so if we want to table it for after some was more it, relevant questions.
No, I'm happy to address it. What did it just pass? That's how Akita and I am. It was like this
year. It's Thursday, the 23rd.
So it's coming up. So what Nate is referring to is that in Buddhism, in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, they follow a lunar calendar. And based on the lunar calendar, there's all kinds of Buddhist holidays and celebrations. And, you know, for instance, like every full moon, they would, you know, kind of at the monasteries, there'd be like an all-night meditation. A lot of the householders would come and make offerings. And so it's based on like new moon, half moon. The monks and nuns would like redo their precepts, do a forgiveness ceremony. So all this stuff that based on the lunar calendar. The big one, Nate is reminding me and asking why I don't talk about it. The big one is called Vaisak, and it is the full moon in May. I think sometimes it falls in April or May, depending on the cycle, but full moon in May, which is Thursday. And it's the highest holiday for Theravadan Buddhists. And I say Theravadan because the Tibetans, I think, sometimes celebrate it in June, or like they have a different, it's not always the same, but in the Theravadan Southeast Asian, full moon in May. And it is the celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment and birth and death. So you know how these things work in religion? It's like he was born, got enlightened, and died all on the full moon in May. Just how it worked out. Absolutely not probably true, but you know, you turn a religious holiday and you say, well, let's celebrate the Buddha's awakening, his birth and his death, all you know, in the kind of spring full moon. And so part of Nate's question, the way that I heard it, was how come as a, you know, against the stream Buddhist meditation society, meditation center, how come I don't do it? How come we don't celebrate the Buddhists' high holidays? Even in the way that I'm explaining it, probably, you know, partially because I'm a little bit skeptical of kind of any sort of religious ceremonies. I don't really see, Buddhism is absolutely a religion to billions of people. And if, you know, and I'm sort of a hesitant, you know, I'll acknowledge like, yes, I'm a Buddhist, but I don't feel religious about Buddhism. I don't really feel like it's my religion. And I feel like sometimes kind of celebrating things like the Buddha's birthday or these, you know, lunar celebrations feels like these religious ceremonies that I personally have a cringe a little bit about Christmas. Like I actually like Christmas as an American materialist tradition, but it has nothing to do with Jesus, right? And so likewise with Vesak, like I have a little bit of like, oh, we're going to kind of assign all of this meaning and celebrate the birth and death and enlightenment of the Buddha on this day as though this day is somehow more sacred or more special. Like in Theravadan Buddhism, they actually would say, you know, your karma increases on the full moon. And on the high, you know, and on Vesak, like you're, it's so important to follow the precepts and to go and practice generosity. It's like a merit multiplier. And I'm just like, this is religious bullshit. It doesn't increase your karma or your merit. This is priestcraft to try to get you to give. I should try it. Okay, I'm going to try it. Every dollar you donate tonight will be karmically multiplied. It's, you know, for me, I'm just like, come on. So Nate, I'm a fucking skeptic. You know that about me. You've been practicing with me for years. I don't love the religion of Buddhism. I love the teachings of the Buddha and the effect that the teachings of Buddha have had in my life. I can get very critical of the patriarchal set. In Against the Stream, you've read it, Nate. I make a statement that I say, I think as soon as the Buddha died, some of the emphasis on equality and on breaking down some of the hierarchical and sexist and, you know, kind of, I think that as soon as he wasn't there, those forces of sexism, those forces of greed came back in. And that a lot of the Buddhist religious stuff is beautiful, and they make these beautiful temples and they make these beautiful artworks, and Buddhism as a religion is in a state of incredible decline as far as ethics and as far as wisdom. I don't know if you've probably heard me say this before. I was surprised when I heard this, but it was a long time ago, so I've sort of digested it. Less than 10% of Buddhist monastics meditate. The less of 10% of people who are religiously Buddhist celebrating Vesak on Thursday because it's going to increase their karma actually practice the principles that the Buddha taught. It's one of the reasons why I'm a little bit, you know, about religion. because I'm not interested in faith. I'm not interested in ritual. I'm interested in personal human transformation. And I'm very interested in the topic tonight of how do we use our life to create a positive change on the planet, not at church, not at, you know, the high holidays, the high Buddhist celebrations. And, you know, as a skeptical Western Buddhist, I also don't put a lot of emphasis on some of that stuff, because people that are just coming in, I think it's more welcoming to be like, we're a meditation community. Yes, we're talking about the Buddhist teachings, but I'm not getting you to bow. I'm not getting you to do offerings. That's very kind of secular and welcoming in a way that when we start talking about Buddhist holidays, it gets a little too religious. And then everybody with their Catholic, trauma is like, this is just like church. You know, we're fucking bowing and we're making offerings, and pretty soon you're going to have us eating wafers and or whatever religious trauma you come in with. So that's why. That having been said, I'm going to Thailand next week and I'll be bowing to the monks every day. And I don't hate it actually when I'm doing it. I just couldn't bring myself to creating that kind of culture for you. When I'm part of their culture and I'm in that, and I'm at the temples and I'm at the monastery and I'm with the monks, I like being devotional because it's what's appropriate there. I just didn't feel like I could create that for us, and me being the teacher and having you guys, kind of have that level of hierarchy and devotion just never felt right for our community. Who was that? There was a hand over there. Yeah, Kiki.
Hey. I have a question about, it might be related to everything. I have a really fabulous case to sue somebody, and I'm getting a lot of pressure and a lot of people to sue this person.
Yeah.
And I've kind of gone through this before. I was mauled by a pit bull, and everyone's like, "Well, sue the guys, fuck them, sue them." I felt very embarrassed that I didn't want to, and I feel very embarrassed again that I don't want to. And I have quote unquote every right to, and I quote unquote should, and I could take the whole company and blah blah blah, and all these people. Can I blame?
Yes. The answer is yes. You can. blame what? Oh, no.
A Buddhist practice or even interest in it for just not doing that. It's not hard to, because hear me out. I think it would cause more damage. Like, I just think it's more chaos. It's more damage. It's more. Is that okay? Does that kind of align with? That's why I mean,
I'd have to hear more of the specifics, but I mostly just land in like, trust yourself. If you don't want to do something just because people are like, hey, you could financially benefit, and you're like, that's not my motive. And also the understanding of karma is like, whatever harm was caused, they aren't getting away with it. They're, they own that karma of it. Now, there is something to holding people accountable. And sometimes a legal system is useful in kind of holding people accountable for harmful actions. Even if you're like, hey, I don't really want the money but I also don't want them to continue to cause harm. And so I am going to do this lawsuit that will hopefully shut them down in some way that will, they won't continue to cause harm. So, thinking it through of like, I don't really want it, but I don't want them to continue to cause harm. So I'll participate in the lawsuit or whatever it is. Ultimately, trust yourself though. Like if you don't want to do it, don't let anybody guilt you into it or say like, hey, what a lost opportunity to make money. And if you're kind of like, that's just not how I want to make money. And they have their karma. And I'm going to walk away and with more integrity or whatever it is. Not that there's anything wrong, really. Sometimes we do need to use the judicial system to, sue each other. Sometimes, you know, I think sometimes it is the appropriate action, but of course we live in this culture where it's like so abused and we're so quick to try to sue rather than communicate.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're out of time. It's 8:30. If you didn't get to ask a question, I can hang out for a little bit after if you want to talk. Thanks everybody for being here. Your donations karmically will be multiplied Thursday. So please be as generous. I did the math recently and we're running at a few thousand dollars, like close to $5,000 a month deficit. And I had some extra money and I had some SBA loans. And so we've been sort of floating on it, but we're bringing in about $5,000 a month with the donations, and our expenses are closer to $10,000 a month. So what Against the Stream needs is 50 more, you know, there's 80 people, 90 people here tonight, including the online and in person. If 50 more people from the Sangha do a $100 a month donation, then we'll meet that extra $5,000 a month that we need kind of for our monthly needs. So just consider that. Maybe you're already giving, you know, $25 or $50 a month. Consider if you can up it to $100, or if you're not doing a monthly thing, think about it. Can you do $100 a month to support this place continuing to function in the way that we want it to be able to be here, voluntary, free of charge, and everybody welcome? So just know that the Sangha does need, I need, to raise some money in order to support the place, about $5,000 a month. So 50 people giving $100 a month, or 100 people giving $50 a month, rather than just the $20 here and $20 there that most people do. It doesn't quite cut it. It used to cut it. When there was 100 people in the room all of the time, it was enough. And we also had some major donors back there where people were writing $50,000 checks somewhat regularly to the nonprofit. That's not happening anymore. The Sangha's smaller. The major donors aren't present as they used to be. So, but we've got, you know, 80 to 100 people here every Monday. And if we're just, you know, everybody's pitching in, it'll meet it. You know, and that's what will happen. So thank you for considering that and being as generous as you can be. And happy Vaisak to everybody. May any goodness comes from our practice be shared with each other, shared with this world. May each of us create the positive change that we can. And together, may we really shift the conversation and the quality of existence on this planet. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.